From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Puerto Rico is having a big battle with the Zika virus right now. The CDC estimates that a quarter of the territory's population could be infected with Zika by the end of the year. Zika is at the doorstep of the United States, creeping north. What can we learn? What must we learn from Puerto Rico's efforts and stumbles? This hour on Point, Puerto Rico, ground zero in the U.S. fight against Zika. You can join us on air or online when you hear a quarter of Puerto Rico could be infected by Zika by the end of the year. Where do your thoughts take you? Is the continental U.S. up to the challenge? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Atlanta, home to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Betsy McKay is with us, senior writer covering global health for The Wall Street Journal. You can link to her reporting on the Zika crisis in Puerto Rico on our website, onpointradio.org. Betsy McKay, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So this CDC estimate of 25% of Puerto Rico's 3.5 million people possibly being infected with Zika by the end of the year. Why is Puerto Rico so vulnerable right now?
Yeah, well, you know, Puerto Rico is awash with this mosquito, the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which is the main carrier of the Zika virus. It's, you know, right smack dab in the middle of the Caribbean. It's a tropical climate. It's sort of the perfect breeding ground for this mosquito and this virus. It's, you know, living conditions there also are very conducive to the spread of Zika. Mm-hmm. A lot of people living in very close quarters. This mosquito likes to live indoors and around people. And when you live in homes that don't have window screens, don't have air conditioning, mosquitoes are flying in and out, you know, you can get a lot of spread of Zika. And so that is what's currently going on there.
Here's Dr. Tom Frieden, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, speaking about the threat of the Zika virus. He says here that the CDC is very concerned about the spread of Zika in Puerto Rico.
The front line of the battle against Zika in the U.S. is Puerto Rico. And we are very concerned that Puerto Rico could have hundreds of thousands of Zika infections and potentially thousands of pregnant women infected with Zika.
Hundreds of thousands of Zika infections, potentially thousands of pregnant women infected with Zika. You were in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Betsy, what did you hear from people there?
Well, you know, the numbers are certainly moving up. You know, on the one hand, at the time I was there, there were about 1,300 people who have tested positive for Zika. And nearly 170 pregnant women. But the epidemic has just started. The other thing is that Zika infects people, most people, asymptomatically. In other words, they don't know they're infected. They never get any symptoms. Mm. And then probably many who do get symptoms, because the symptoms of Zika are mild, don't get tested. So there are, you know, people estimate that there are thousands more who have been infected, on top of those who've tested positive.
You mentioned this.
It's certainly moving in that direction.
Right. The symptoms you say are mild. What are they?
They're, you know, people describe it as like having a bad cold or a mild flu. You know, some get a mild fever. There are a couple distinguishing things. Most everybody gets some a skin rash. It's been described to me, but it's hard to imagine. It's just kind of this red, bizarre rash. The other thing is conjunctivitis, which is, you know, basically like an eye infection. Mm-hmm. And those are tend to be the three most common things. Also kind of joint aches. And it doesn't last long. It's a couple of days, 3 days. So we've all felt that, you know, had something like that at some point in our lives and not even gone to the doctor.
Here's Catherine Merced. She's a pregnant mother in Puerto Rico. She's not contracted Zika, but in May she attended a counseling session at a Women, Infant, and Children's Center because she wanted to learn more about ways to stay safe from the virus through her pregnancy. This is an interpreted by PBS.
I'm terrified, worried more than anything because it could be sexually transmitted to me.
So the World Health Organization, Betsy McKay, calls Zika a global health emergency, has suggested that people living in areas where the Zika virus is circulating consider delaying pregnancy, which obviously affects millions of couples in many countries, remind us of the health implications for babies infected with Zika.
Yeah, it's terrible. So the fetuses, the embryos and fetuses of pregnant women, if infected with this virus loves nerve cells, essentially, and it has, you know, it causes brain damage. It infects the brain cells, the nerve cells that produce brain cells, so it prevents the brain from forming, and it also destroys existing brain cells in a developing fetus. So it's very, very severe. There's kind of a range of types of damage that have been seen so far in infants in Brazil and, you know, now starting in Puerto Rico and Colombia and other places. But generally, it's pretty bad, and it's worse than what scientists and doctors thought they were seeing initially. So I should also mention that in adults, a very small number, but it's rare, this virus has also led to Guillain-Barré syndrome, mm-hmm. which is the immune system, again, attacking the nervous system, and it can paralyze you for weeks, sometimes months. Most people recover, but it's not a good thing. So this virus loves the nervous system.
Zika has made a relentless march across the Americas, Latin America, the Caribbean, down in Brazil. The virus spread unnoticed for months. Give us a sense of how quickly Zika has spread in really a relatively short period of time, Betsy.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable. So the virus is believed to have arrived in Brazil sometime probably in 2013, but wasn't noticed until last year. And in fact, you know, it was in the spring last year where they finally figured out what was this virus was there and was spreading and had never been there before. And it wasn't until last fall that doctors began seeing these an unusual number of babies being born with what's called microcephaly, or smaller heads. Then they figured out that the heads were smaller because there's, you know, extensive brain damage. So from there, you know, then it was identified in Colombia in October and had just kind of rapidly spread through a lot of Latin America, mostly the tropical areas. You know, it's been seen in Mexico, and has now spread all through the Caribbean. I mean, we focus a lot on Puerto Rico, but it's, you know, all over the place in Haiti, Dominican Republic. I mean, the Virgin Islands, Martinique. So now it's moving towards the continental U.S. I would say, you know, in Puerto Rico, it's covered about three-quarters of the island now. It's expected to cover the whole island, the virus. And mosquito season is starting here in the U.S. So the CDC and state and local health departments are expecting that there will be some cases here.
Well, we'll talk about what U.S. health officials are learning from Puerto Rico that will help in the fight as Zika creeps north. But let me bring in first here from San Juan, Puerto Rico, Dr. Johnny Ruyan, former health secretary of Puerto Rico. He came out of retirement and is now advisor for the Zika epidemic to the governor of Puerto Rico. Dr. Ruyan, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you, sir.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you very much.
So what are some of the challenges that Puerto Rico is experiencing when it comes to the Zika virus?
Well, you know, we're trying to develop a surveillance system that can give us some answers. We know that a pregnant woman who gets Zika has 50 times more chance of having a baby with microcephaly than a pregnant woman who doesn't have Zika. What we don't know is once the mother is infected, what percentage of the babies are going to have microcephaly or neural disease. In French Polynesia, it was 1%, and in Brazil, it was 29%. So we should know by August, September, October, we should know what the number is in Puerto Rico, and because we have tested more than 40% of pregnant women, we can also give some guidance as to the best time to test the pregnant woman in first trimester. We're testing all our pregnant females in the second trimester and interpreting that test for that they can have an informed decision if to carry to 40 weeks or medical abortion is permitted till week 22. And so that gives the pregnant women a chance then to have the follow-up with amniocentesis, with sonograms every 4 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully will help in the prevention of the spread of the Zika to the baby.
Well, beyond testing, doctor, what is the government doing in terms of prevention?
Yeah, we've focused very strongly on source reduction. So we've gone to all the cemeteries, cleared out all the flower bases. We've worked with all the old tires. We've removed over 1.3 million old tires. We work with the junkers, with the abandoned homes, working with the community and educating the fact that people should know that this mosquito bites during the day. It feeds inside the home. So it's from 6 in the morning to 10 in the morning, and then afternoon from 4 to 6.
Hmm.
Trying to educate tourists that the risk gradient for tourists is very, very low.
Well, why would that be? Why would tourists have a lower risk rate?
Because they usually don't visit homes. They stay in hotel rooms. Hotel rooms have air conditioning. They stay in the beach in the area where there's a lot of wind. There's no mosquitoes in the home, in the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, this mosquito radiates 50 meters from the home. So it hides under the bed. It hides in the closet. It hides under the furniture. And it's a domestic mosquito. It's only the female that bites. The male's not interested in biting humans. And so the female needs it for the cycle of the egg production. So she'll be looking for us early in the morning and late afternoon. Mm-hmm. And those tourists that visit homes would then have to have a repellent, as well as all the local people that need to make sure, and our pregnant women need to make sure that they put on the repellent at 6 in the morning and repeat it at 2 in the afternoon, so that she gets protected from a mosquito bite or from her husband or boyfriend.
Where it's sexually transmitted, right? Dr. Johnny Rion, thank you so much. Stick with us. We're talking about the battle against Zika, also with Betsy McKay, senior writer at the Wall Street Journal. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the outbreak of Zika in Puerto Rico, the front lines of the battle against Zika in the United States. And you can join the conversation. Is the World Health Organization right that the Olympics should go ahead in Brazil? What about its suggestion that women should delay pregnancy in infected areas? Betsy McKay is with me this hour, senior writer at the Wall Street Journal covering global health. And from San Juan, Puerto Rico, Dr. Johnny Rion. He's with us. He's advising the government of Puerto Rico on the Zika outbreak. Here's Puerto Rico's governor, Alejandro Garcia Padilla, speaking with the PBS NewsHour in May. He said that the Zika virus should not detour tourists from visiting Puerto Rico unless they were pregnant or hoping to become pregnant.
Anyone can travel to Puerto Rico. The U.S. Olympic team will go to Rio in a couple of months, and that's the Mecca of Zika. So it's safe to travel here. But if the woman is pregnant or trying to, then they should avoid to come to Puerto Rico.
Betsy McKay, Zika virus is creeping north. What are health officials in the United States learning from Puerto Rico that will help us fight Zika in the U.S.?
Well, you know, Puerto Rico is unusual for that part of the, you know, for the Caribbean. It has advantages over other Caribbean islands and Latin American countries in that it has it's part of the U.S., so it has the same modern medical system and surveillance capabilities that we have. And so, you know, just tracking and setting up studies that the health department, you know, the local government, scientists there, and the CDC, which has a branch in Puerto Rico, you know, they're able to follow a population that officials in Brazil and, you know, global health officials weren't able to do. In Brazil, you know, the epidemic was already raging when everybody, you know, understood what was going on. In Puerto Rico,
They knew about it from the start. They were watching for it. They identified the first case late last year. And so they've been able to track, you know, pregnancies, and they'll be able to study, you know, how many people really are infected but never develop symptoms. They're studying cases of how many cases there are of Guillain-Barré syndrome. They've even found a case of encephalitis. So these are things, you know, everyone there will say, and rightly so, the first job is to control this disease and keep people from getting infected. But along the way, they're able to learn things that will help Puerto Rico, but also help the rest of the world understand the damage that Zika can do. Right now, there's just a lot about Zika that's not known. It's not really known what the risk is to a woman. If you're a pregnant woman, what percentage, you know, what risk is there that mm-hmm. your fetus will be harmed, for example?
Dr. Ruyan, the World Health Organization says Zika is spreading explosively, and we've heard the suggestion here that women living in Zika-infected areas should delay pregnancy. How are women in Puerto Rico responding to that, number one, and what would it mean should thousands of women, pregnant women, become infected with the virus?
Yeah, well, you know, we're asking women who are trying to get pregnant voluntarily and, you know, and have it planned to delay 1 year, see what happens with the percentage of babies that will be infected. Also, the screening tests are getting better. We're in the hope of a vaccine in the future. And there's, you know, there's oral contraceptives and all those methods that are being used now to attack it so that our numbers of pregnant women from 100 a day can go down to perhaps half. From the point of view of what pregnant women are doing, well, they are getting tested in the first trimester. They're getting tested again if negative in the middle of the second trimester. Mm-hmm. And if they come out positive, then they go to the OBGYN and get the amniocentesis mm-hmm. on week 16, and then to see if the baby has been infected or not, if the virus has passed the placenta. And if the virus has passed the placenta, then a serial sonogram every 4 weeks to measure the growth of the brain and to note to see if there's any calcifications in the intracranial part of the brain and to monitor the baby once it's born until they're 3 years old. Hmm. So this way it's very important to have understand the natural spectrum of disease and to then portray this information. We're publishing regularly at the CDC Journal, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report, and just sharing the information with the rest of the world as we find out about it.
Let's get a call in here. Eric in Miami, Florida. Eric, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just had a quick question about, I guess, this epidemic compared to the Ebola outbreak. Mm-hmm. Initially, as a layperson, my impression with Ebola is that we should be very worried and then maybe not so worried. So I guess my question is, how does this epidemic relatively compare in its size, the rate of growth, along those lines?
Good question, Eric. Thank you. Betsy McKay.
Yeah, it's very, very different in a lot of ways. Ebola is an extremely deadly disease, but doesn't spread as fast or as easily. You know, to get Ebola, to contract Ebola from another, you contract it from contact with actual human contact with another person, contact with their bodily fluids. Zika is spread by a mosquito, so it has spread far more widely than Ebola did. That said, you know, Zika doesn't make most of us very sick at all. You know, from the layperson's point of view, there's not much to be worried about. What there is to be worried about is pregnant women and the few adults who do develop these neurological conditions for which they have to be hospitalized. So it's a you know, Zika is very interesting in that it's a much more complex disease in some ways societally. We all need to try to avoid getting it and keep ourselves from being infected for two reasons. One, we all need to work together to protect pregnant women. The other thing I would say about Zika is it has continued to surprise us in the types of damage it can do. I mean, it seems pretty mild, but in the beginning of all this, nobody knew what it could do to unborn babies, mm-hmm. and nobody really knew that it could be sexually transmitted. And just last week, a paper was published that found a couple who were both infected, and neither one of them knew it, and the husband passed it to the wife. So I would say those are the two. There are two compelling reasons not to be infected, even though it seems very mild.
Let's get Carl in here from Binghamton, New York. Carl, welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi, Jane. My comment is just that, why, with Puerto Rico being the one of the few barriers to transmission to the United States, and with their economy just about tanked, why is our ridiculous Congress trying to further tighten the financial screws on Puerto Rico? So not only can they not help protect us, but the burden on them is going to be even greater.
Carl, thank you. It's an excellent point. Here's President Obama actually at the White House speaking after a meeting with health officials about Zika and the response efforts coming out of Congress.
Understand that this is not something where we can build a wall to prevent mosquitoes don't go through customs. To the extent that we're not handling this thing on the front end, we're going to have bigger problems on the back end.
Dr. Rion, there are tremendous economic implications here. Puerto Rico's having a hard time, as we all know, economically. I mean, as far as preparing for Zika, treating people who have it and babies who are born with it, talk about the financials here.
Every baby born with microcephaly or neurological disease is going to cost society $10 million during the lifespan.
$10 million?
$10 million. That's what's predicted. Not to mention what happens to the family. So every time we have a pregnant woman that gets infected, we don't know if it's going to be 1% or 29%, but let's say it's 10%. So last week in Puerto Rico, there were 20 women that got infected. That would mean that there's two babies that are going to be born with microcephaly or neurological disease in the future, and that basically adds up $20 million in lifetime. So an ounce of prevention is much more effective than a pound of cure and much more effective than a ton of rehabilitation. Mm. And so what we have to be smart here is be dollar smart and penny foolish. And what the Congress is doing right now is being penny wise and pound foolish. So the more we delay the funding and trying to get to long-term protection over here, get rid of the vector control. If Puerto Rico comes up with a policy where we actually go for elimination and perhaps eradication of the mosquito, we will not have in the future dengue or chikungunya or yellow fever or Zika, which are the four diseases that this vector can transmit. Mm-hmm. In Puerto Rico, we have three of the four. We have dengue, we have chikungunya, and now we have Zika. Mm. And the difference is that, different from Ebola, which is only in three countries in Africa and never left those three countries, this has spread to 39 countries in the Americas and has continued to spread in the United States this summer.
Spread so fast. Dr. Rion, thank you. Let me bring in another voice here. Dr. Frank Welsh joins me from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He is the medical director for Louisiana's Department of Health and Hospitals Center of Community Preparedness. Dr. Welsh, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. How are you viewing the Zika outbreak there on the Gulf Coast in Louisiana?
I think Louisiana is very similar to many of the other states, Florida, Alabama, Texas, and then the other states at risk, California, Hawaii. We are taking this very, very seriously. Not only do we have the risk of imported travelers coming in with Zika, but we do have the mosquito, both mosquitoes that spread Zika, and actually quite a concentration of them near some of our more populated areas. So we are planning for this threat very, very seriously as we move into the summer mosquito season.
So the Centers for Disease Control just released a plan that describes how the agency would respond should a Zika mosquito infect someone in the U.S., in Hawaii. What does that plan say, and how does that affect you?
So that plan was basically developed about 6 months ago, and most states are following that. It has us planning sort of in six categories.
Okay.
They are communications, laboratory, epidemiology and surveillance, maternal and child health, blood banking, and vector control. And it has us also planning in four phases: before the mosquito, when the mosquito is active, once we have a local case, and then if we have more than one area of local case. So it's kind of a accelerating plan in six stages. And we as a state and all the other states have been planning using this template hand in hand with the CDC, hoping that by using this plan, we prevent locally transmitted cases. But if we do get them, how do we partner together to respond and react and try and minimize local transmission?
So is mosquito control in your area just a steady march of insecticide and mosquito traps and all the rest? Is that a big piece of this?
So there is a piece of mosquito traps and surveillance for the particular mosquito, and there is a somewhat of a role for spraying. But many of your listeners know this particular mosquito, the same one that spreads yellow fever, but also the diseases dengue fever and chikungunya, is really a yard mosquito. So the best thing we can advise people to do in our planning is get rid of that standing water once a week in your yard. And that is what's going to really be the front lines of mosquito and vector control, along with, if we have local transmission, surveillance of both humans and mosquitoes, and then that boots on the ground, just like you said, spraying, dumping over things, if that worst-case scenario happens.
Let's get Geraldine in here from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Geraldine. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hello,
Hi.
Panelists. My question concerns my one-year-old son. I know when I was pregnant and every other woman, we're always advised to, eat right and, get enough of the lutein and omega-3 for their brain development. And I know now with him, with his diet, we're still encouraged to include those items in his diet for mm-hmm. brain development. My concern is once a child is born who hasn't been exposed but does get bitten, how does the virus impact a young child's neurological development?
That's a good question, Geraldine. Thank you very much. Dr. Welch?
Geraldine, thank you for that question. And I think one of the other speakers said it before. There is so much about Zika we don't actually know. Now, from what we do know is that after a baby is born, and say for a one-year-old, we believe that this is a relatively mild illness that really does not have any long-term consequences once the brain has developed. But that's just our preliminary evidence right now. As one of your other speakers said, we really do need to follow over time to see if there's more mild consequences that may happen if a very young child gets it and what would happen later on. But currently, we do not think that a one-year-old would be at any more at risk than the rest of us, given that they have fully developed brain. But we really don't know for sure.
Geraldine, thank you. Let's squeeze in Cheryl here from Blue Hill, Maine. Cheryl, welcome to On Point. Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a question. I actually have been living in the Caribbean, and I did have chikungunya. And my daughter also had chikungunya. And the way I understand it, the chikungunya sort of, you can have lasting symptoms from the viral particles sort of finding their way out.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, and I don't know if this is known, but is this, is Zika acting more like, like a cold virus where you get a cold and then you're done with the cold until the next virus comes along? Or is this acting more like a herpes virus where, mm-hmm. when you get shingles? I'm going down to the islands with my 16-year-old daughter in the next couple of weeks, and I'm concerned that, is this going to be something that, maybe 8-10 years from now when she's ready to have children
lays dormant in your system.
Yeah,
I hear you, Cheryl. It's a great question. Dr. Welch, would you respond?
I sure will. And so fortunately, we believe that once somebody has Zika virus and they recover from that viremic illness, that they are immune for life. It is not similar to those ones, the herpes virus like that was mentioned, that stays dormant within you. So that is why we are so hopeful about a vaccine in the upcoming future. For example, if you asked women to delay pregnancy for 6 months and then the vaccine was available, then a woman would be immune from Zika and then could proceed with her pregnancy with no fear. So just even a short time frame for us to catch up with this disease, gain a better understanding, hopefully develop a vaccine is really what we need.
Dr. Frank Welch, Medical Director of Louisiana's Center for Community Preparedness. Great to have you, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Dr. Johnny Rion, last question here. We have 30 seconds before the break. What should we know in the United States based on your experience with Zika in Puerto Rico?
Basically, it comes in with the mosquito, but then it amplifies the sexual transmission. So if it starts transmitting by mosquito, then you have to deal with both things, the mosquito prevention and the sexual transmission prevention.
Dr. Johnny Rion, former health secretary of Puerto Rico and now advisor to the governor. Dr. Johnny, thank you so much for your time, sir, and good luck down there.
Thank you very much. Good day.
Thank you. We're discussing the Zika outbreak and what we're doing in Puerto Rico and beyond to protect people. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the Zika epidemic and how communities in the United States are preparing for it. You can join the conversation. Are you screening the porch, stocking up on bug spray, rethinking how you will spend the summer outside? Here's Republican Florida Governor Rick Scott. He went to Washington, D.C. in May to call on Congress to approve Zika funding. He spoke with reporters.
Rain's going to be coming. Heat's going to be coming. We're going to have the Olympics. This is an urgent need. We need to be doing this now. We need to come to a conclusion now. We need to prepare before we have the crisis.
Betsy McKay, senior global writer for The Wall Street Journal, is with me. Betsy, talk about the funding for Zika. President Obama asked for a whopping $1.9 billion. How much did he get, and where does that stand?
Well, they're still hoping for it. It's, you know, been debated by Congress for quite some time. And what public health officials will tell you is we need this money now. Mosquito season is starting. You know, I think the bigger question is we have more and more epidemics now. You know, we just went through this with Ebola, and a year and a half later, they've gone back to Congress to ask for money for Zika. And, you know, why are we doing it this way? We have an epidemic that is spreading, and, you know, need to ask for emergency funding to address it, and it takes a while. Even if a decision is made quickly, it takes a while to get that money out. Mm. You know, in this country, we don't say, okay, can we have some money to fight the terrorists and then wait for that money? And I think, you know, what people in public health will tell you is it's kind of the same with viruses and bacteria, and we're sort of living in a new world where these epidemics are happening more often. So that is starting to raise discussions about what kind of, you know, ongoing fund could there be so that these types of back and forths don't have to happen and responses can happen quicker.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Gregory Lanzaro, he joins me from Davis, California. He's professor and researcher in pathology, microbiology, and immunology at the University of California, Davis. He studies vectors of human diseases, especially mosquitoes, and has been working on a gene drive, something that many scientists say could help in the fight against Zika. Greg Lanzaro, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jay.
So this is a controversial and powerful new genetic editing technology that some biologists say could really eliminate local mosquito populations. Tell us about it. How does it work?
The system is called these are genetic elements that are homing. The one that's I think been in the news the most lately is a system called CRISPR-Cas9. This is basically the CRISPR part. CRISPR stands for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. That's a mouthful. So CRISPR, that's describing a DNA sequence that's viral by origin, it's thought. The system includes a protein that's called Cas9. That's CRISPR-associated protein 9. These were first discovered in bacteria and were thought to be a sort of primitive immune system in bacteria. So basically what these do is they attach to a very specific sequence of DNA, cut that DNA, and then the system deattaches, and then the natural DNA repair system of the host takes place. And we can take advantage of that by inserting foreign DNA in the site where this break occurs. That's how it works.
Bottom line, scientists essentially alter the DNA of an individual organism. In this case, it would be mosquitoes, right?
Correct.
Which then that mosquito goes back into the population and eliminates the entire population of organisms?
No. So the way the idea works is we can take this CRISPR system and we can insert other genes that we want expressed. In the case of mosquitoes, it would either be something that would kill the mosquito or suppress the population in some way, or a gene that would render the mosquito resistant to whatever pathogen, for example, Zika or a malaria parasite. Mm. And then if we have this CRISPR system integrated into the mosquito and we release it into a natural population, very quickly that gene will spread rapidly through the population because of the CRISPR system, which changes the inheritance of the...
So over time, down generations, then certain mosquitoes are out of the system.
Yeah, so basically the released mosquitoes will mate with wild-type mosquitoes at the release site.
Yeah.
And then the system, because of the gene drive, the CRISPR-Cas9, every offspring produced by a female that's mated with an individual carrying this gene will also carry it. And then all of their offspring will carry it, and you can see it's sort of a chain reaction. Very quickly, it will become the predominant gene, and maybe even every individual in that population will
be carrying it. Well, so the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, which is the premier advisory group for the federal government on scientific matters, has endorsed continued research on this technology, and has suggested carefully controlled field trials. I mean, obviously there are hefty ethical questions within the scientific community and beyond about what gene drives do. What are some of those questions?
So basically what we're talking about here is actually engineering populations. You know, we've talked for a long time about engineering individual organisms in the laboratory, but here we're talking about altering natural populations of organisms, in this case mosquitoes. So the issues are, for one thing, there's a concern that the gene element could spread beyond where we want it.
Mm-hmm.
It could potentially move between species. That's another concern, although very unlikely, but it's possible. And then just a lot of unknowns about what the potential effect could be on the environment at large. For example, what happens if we eradicate a mosquito population? What are the impacts on the environment? So these are some of the issues that have been voiced.
Right. So for the purpose of this conversation, you can get rid of a mosquito population to get rid of Zika. You know, you could eliminate malaria, for that matter. You could modify ticks, right, so they don't carry Lyme disease.
That's
you
correct.
Could eliminate weeds from our farms. But what if you wipe out an entire species only to learn later that maybe that was vital in some unforeseen way, that particular species?
Yeah, that's correct. So, I mean, I think at this point, scientists are going to proceed carefully.
Mm-hmm.
You're correct in saying that, and the Academy is correct in saying that what we really need right now are carefully controlled field trials. So we need to put these things out in a place where we can control it as best as we can, and you know, mitigate it if problems do arise.
So interesting. Stick with us, Greg. Let's go back to the phones here. A lot of Zika questions. Sabrina is first in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Sabrina. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My family is traveling to Rio this summer for the Olympics, and at this point, we haven't made a final decision, but I'm pretty sure we're still going to go. It was pretty expensive, and we're not going to get our money back if we don't go. But I was wondering if the experts are worried that the spread of this is going to be exponential in the U.S. as a result of all these people traveling basically to ground zero, going to the country, and then coming back here to the U.S.
Sabrina, thank you. Betsy McKay, speak to this. I mean, the World Health Organization said this week that there's, quote, a very low risk of further international spread, speaking about the Olympic Games. Although Brazil was the right epicenter of this, right? 100,000 cases alone? How do you see it?
Right. This is a very controversial issue, actually. And the WHO, World Health Organization, discussed it in a meeting yesterday. They did say that they feel there's a low risk of international spread from the Olympics, even though they are in Rio. And that's for two reasons. One, the games are actually taking place in the wintertime in Rio. And traditionally or historically,
circulation of mosquitoes at that point in time in August and September is at its lowest levels during the year.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some disease spread, but it's very low. The second reason is that the Brazilian officials are undertaking a lot of efforts to eliminate mosquitoes, spraying, fogging, all these, you know, emptying containers with water, just, you know, surveillance for the mosquitoes in Olympic venues. It's not everywhere around the Olympics, and the WHO has urged the Brazilians to be more active, to continue their efforts, and also to be a little more public about it. I mean, one problem here, I think, is that we're not getting a lot of information generally in the public about what is being done to control transmission. Mm. So, and the third thing is that the CDC and WHO have both said that when you look at overall international travel to and from countries where Zika is circulating, travel to the Olympics, I mean, the Olympics are expecting up to 500,000, half a million people, visitors, and then like 10,000 athletes.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a very low percentage of overall travel. So, in fact, the CDC said it was 0.25% of all travel in and out of country. So they don't think it will further international spread. When it comes to the U.S., you know, what would happen, the way Zika will start spreading here is someone comes back from, Brazil or Colombia or, you know, somewhere where Zika is spreading, and they come back to an area where this mosquito that spreads Zika lives. You get bitten, and that mosquito goes and bites somebody else and, you know, takes the virus with them and infects them, and it goes from there. So, but a lot of things have to happen. You still have to have the virus in your body, and the virus doesn't stay long. So, they are making this argument that the Olympics are just a few weeks away. It's a big deal. And the actual risks they feel for spread are very low. The individual risks, you know, they did say each person has to evaluate for themselves. And, for example, pregnant women shouldn't go.
Right. Sabrina, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Bob calling from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Jane. This is Bob Harrison. I am a pediatric infectious disease doctor and an epidemiologist in Savannah. I just wanted to make 2 points.
All right.
One is that that for the Olympics, everyone's trying to minimize the risk based on scientific knowledge. There's a lot of money at risk with these Olympics. But one, regardless of how low the risk is in general, the one really good way to spread a disease is to get 50,000 people into a soccer stadium. Mm-hmm. With a few infected people and a few mosquitoes,
mm-hmm.
regardless of how low the risk is in the general population, when you bring all the people together with a few infected people, and most of those people in the soccer stadium are susceptible, that's a good way to spread it. The second point is that no one's really talked about the Catholic Church in all this. A lot of Latin America, including Puerto Rico, is Catholic, and there are a lot of women who have they would fulfill the criteria for medical abortions. So the church, in some way, really, really has to deal with this proactively.
Got it, Bob. Thank you. I appreciate your call. Another interesting point to this story, for sure. Steve in Brattleboro, Vermont. Steve, you're on the air. Welcome.
Jane, thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I'd been traveling in Cuba most of the winter,
mm-hmm.
and it was very obvious that they were taking the Zika issue very, very seriously. And the one place in the Caribbean and the Latin American basin and so on that is a success story in control of Zika so far is Cuba. And there are similarities between Cuba and Puerto Rico in the sense that Cuba is a poor country, but the difference is public health is taken as a priority. And, you know, the Cubans are doing things in very cost-effective ways. You know, we tend to invest on the top end of things and so on. But I'm just wondering, you know, I would like to advocate for more collaboration with the Cubans on how to go about doing this. They've only had a few cases, all imported from Guatemala and other countries
mm-hmm.
and so on. I've had meetings canceled because the whole building was being sprayed and so on.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, to ignore the public health lessons from Cuba is at our own peril. Mm. because Cuba, in fact, is controlling the Zika spread. They're taking it very seriously in terms of education, in terms of going into every home, in terms of the spraying, and so on.
They're doing it. I hear you, Steve. I got to let you go because of our time here, but it's an excellent point. Greg Lanzaro, let me wrap up with you here. You tell us some fascinating research on this genetic editing of specific to this conversation of mosquitoes. Brazil has been releasing genetically modified mosquitoes. Is that right? And how is that effort working there?
That's correct. They're using a system that doesn't include gene drive, which is what we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it's similar to programs that have been used in the United States, where insects are sterilized. In this case, they're engineered in a way to make them sterile. And then very large numbers of these mosquitoes are released. When the males that are released mate with natural females, the females don't lay any eggs. Mm. That's the way that system works.
Got it.
And I think it's been fairly effective there.
So fascinating. Betsy McKay, I'll give you the last word here in our last 20 or 30 seconds. Looking forward, what do you say? How do you warn us?
I would say that it's really good that public health entities and mosquito control folks and so forth in the U.S. are really on guard and on the watch for this virus because, as we've said, it's spread really fast.
Betsy McKay, senior writer covering global health for The Wall Street Journal. Really appreciate your time, Betsy, and your insights. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jane.
And Greg Lanzaro, professor and researcher at UC Davis. Greg, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure, Jane.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, antidepressants are everywhere. Psychiatrist Dr. Peter Kramer, who told us first about Listen to Prozac, says they really do work. We'll hear from him tomorrow. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.